This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, FloHealth und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 € pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Hello and welcome from to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from Washington DC. I'm Nuala McGovern. Rebecca Kesby is in London. It is the first full day of Donald Trump's second term as President of the United States. He returns to power with a new confidence and a detailed agenda, some of which he began to enact immediately. Shortly after being sworn in, Mr. Trump promised the start of a new era for the United States.
From this day on, the United States of America will be a free, sovereign, and independent nation. We will stand bravely. We will live proudly. We will dream boldly. And nothing will stand in our way because we are Americans. The future is ours. And our golden age has just begun.
Yesterday, I watched President Trump's inaugural address with these Trump supporters that were gathered in a par. They were jubilant, not just at his return, but also his message.
His speech was exactly what he ran on. We're from Texas, so we're big on energy in the border. And he spoke to both of those, and that fired us up.
I'm pretty pumped. Like I said, it's just fun to be amongst, like, fellow Americans. I think regardless of what side you're on, it's just fun to kind of soak in the patriotism.
Well, I feel great. I think our country's going to be in a much better position globally, and I do think that we will move forward and be a stronger country. We look very forward to the next 4 years.
Some of the Trump supporters we met. Well, Molly Ball is the senior political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And I asked her about the implications of President Trump's decision to pardon nearly 1,600 people who were involved in the riots of January 6th in 2021.
Well, it means that the ones who were imprisoned will go free. The ones who had already served their sentences will have the charges taken off their records and expunged, and will have their rights restored. And it really signifies the degree to which Trump is determined to fulfill the most extreme version of some of his promises. You know, people around him often try to temper or soften the things that he said, but he did repeatedly during the campaign a vow to pardon the January 6th rioters, including those who committed violent acts, including those who violently attacked police officers who responded to the riot on that day. Trump has insisted that they are political prisoners who were unfairly prosecuted, and he's very quickly made good on his promises to exonerate them.
We're going to be speaking to some people that were involved in that, both a police officer and a lawyer for a couple of the people who will be released with this pardon. But I'm wondering what else has struck you in the past. Is it almost 24 hours since President Trump took the oath of office?
Well, he has gotten to work very quickly on many of the items on his agenda, including his you know, isolationist desire to remove the United States from international institutions, his attempt to curtail illegal immigration and change the way the federal workforce is managed. But on other things, he has stopped short. He has not yet imposed the sweeping tariffs that he promised. And we know there's some disagreement within the administration about whether and how to go forward with those sweeping tariffs, which most economists expect would be quite disruptive to the U.S. and the world economy. And so I think one of the big questions going forward is whether he'll move forward with those items on his agenda that about which there is disagreement within his administration and within the Republican Party.
And a couple of the issues that people may have heard in our news bulletin, that he has signed an executive order to begin the process of withdrawing the US from the UN's health body, the World Health Organization, also signed off on withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement. Again, I should say. Quick question for you, Molly, before I let you go. My colleagues on Americast, one of the BBC's podcasts, have been discussing that Mr. Trump in the past 24 hours has already changed America. Do you agree?
Well, I think over the past decade, he's changed America. You know, I've been a political reporter for a few decades now, and it is, and he has had a profound effect on the American political scene and on American society. And there is a feeling, particularly with his second election, with this comeback after being out of office for 4 years, that he's really bent the culture in his direction, and we're entering a new, more conservative era, not just politically, but broadly in society. So the question is he able to make good on that mandate in a way that meets the approval of voters, or will they see all these disruptions as disturbing and as going further than what they thought they were getting?
That's Molly Ball, senior political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Well, Winston Pongeon is a former police officer who was on duty that day, January 6, 2021, as a police officer at the Capitol. I wanted to know his reaction to those pardons by President Trump.
A slap in the face to Capitol Police, DC Police, and other law enforcement who quite literally were assaulted that day. It's really an unprecedented thing to know that these violent felons who were convicted by a jury of their peers for crimes that were largely broadcast for all the country and the world to see are going to walk free and be returned to their neighborhoods. For me, I was punched in the face, knocked on my back, pepper sprayed, nearly stabbed by a flagpole. It's just devastating to me, and I'm sure for fellow officers who are still there showing up every single day, not just Capitol Police, but law enforcement across the United States who show up every day in service to their communities, you know, making sacrifices of themselves to better the country.
Some have said who support these pardons that the sentences were too extreme or too long, to put it very simply, that they were overly aggressive in prosecuting them, and that there was political machinations attached to them. What would you say? You were there.
That is not true at all. I mean, you look at the over 1,000 defendants, you know, criminals, and by and large, most of them served less than 30 days, you know, if any prison or jail time at all. So the fact that, you know, the idea that this was politically motivated, somehow exaggerated, is completely false. I think you just need to look at the law and look at how unprecedented the events of January 6th were. Something like this had never happened in our country. You know, our Capitol had never been stormed by fellow Americans, had never been attacked since the War of 1812. So I think that it's very important that those who particularly assaulted law enforcement be held accountable for their actions. And now they're just not being held accountable at all.
So what does this mean for you, Winston? Is there an impact on your daily life from what happened that day?
I hope that this won't change too much. But yes, you know, I ended up leaving the Capitol Police 10 months after January 6th.
Because of that?
Not solely, but I do like to think that had January 6th not happened, I could still be very much working there today because I did love it. I loved most of the officers I worked with and getting to experience that history. And I'm very thankful for the opportunities. And I would do it all over again. But I fear, you know, what does this mean, not just for me, but for other law enforcement and other Americans? Do you really want these violent criminals returning to your neighborhoods? What message does this send to law enforcement and to America Americans and to the world of that, is political violence okay?
That was Winston Pongeon, one of the Capitol building police officers on duty on January 6th. Let me bring in Norm Pattis. He's a lawyer who's defended several rioters, including Zachary Rail and Joseph Biggs. They're two former leaders of the Proud Boys militant group. They've been sentenced, or were, to 15 and 17 years in prison. Good to have you back with us, Norm. Thank you for joining us. Your response to Winston Pongeon, particularly that he feels these pardons send a message to law enforcement agents and other Americans that they may not be safe.
Many law enforcement agents support the pardons. I don't understand the man who just spoke what his other reasons for resigning were, and I'm really not going to respond to him. Mm-hmm. I think that the notion that somehow this event threatens the Republic is overdone. I rely for that on our reaction to the American Civil War 150 or so years ago, a war that cost 600,000 American lives. Within 4 years of the end of that war, every rebel, every member of the Confederacy had been repatriated. No one was in prison. Even Jefferson Davis received a pardon, the former president of the Confederacy, for his suspected role in the assassination of then-President Lincoln. If we could come together as a country after such a violent act, and after people openly took arms and killed one another, if we could stop pursuing them in within 4 years, why were we still prosecuting people for criminal trespass 4 years later over an afternoon's riot? Clearly, it was a threatening riot and an ugly scene. I watched it. I've spent a couple years of my life reviewing evidence involving it, but it wasn't anything near a civil war. So I'm relieved by this.
A couple of things with it, Norm, which I'd be curious for your thoughts on. So the Civil War, obviously a long time ago, some people might feel that instead times have moved on, that perhaps these people should be held to account in a way that was different to the years during the Civil War. Some might see it as the pardoning system being abused, for example. Some people even saying that about former President Joe Biden. But I don't want to get into that. I want to stay specifically with this. It was serious offences that were caused. It was seditious conspiracy for your particular clients. And I wonder, where is the faith in the legal system if, in fact, those convictions don't hold?
Well, that's a good question. And that was one of the debates we had at the founding of this country. We took the pardon power, as we took so much of our law from your example, and somebody had to have it. And there was a debate about whether it should be shared between Congress and the presidency or should repose in the presidency altogether. And we chose the latter option, against the argument that it made him too much like a king. But the theory was that somewhere equity, as you know, the courts of law and equity used to be different. The king's, the court of exchequer is where you went when the law failed and you thought fairness required something more. We've decided for good or ill to let our president have the power to pardon for whatever reason he sees fit. And as yesterday shows, a pardon can create tremendous backlash. As the Biden pardons, a footnote here briefly, show not everybody's happy all the time. And so it was an extraordinary event on January 6, 2021. Yesterday was an extraordinary application of the pardon power. I think it's going to take some time to sort it all out.
With Mr. Rail and Mr. Biggs, do you consider them a threat to society?
Absolutely not. I passionately disagree with the jury's verdict in this case. The government set out in its opening statement, and it was a 5.5 month trial. We went at it. The government said, we're going to prove to you there was a plan to violently oppose the United States government. And at the end of the day, they concluded they hadn't proven a plan. And they told the jury this conspiracy could have been formed instantaneously at the moment the first barricade was breached. And they used as evidence of that statements that are otherwise protected under law.
May I jump in, Norm, because we've only got 20 seconds. Yeah. Do you believe this is the end of the road for these particular convictions, or do you expect more litigation? 20 seconds.
I expect more litigation. There's a very significant case being argued as we speak in D.C. about whether the executive branch can order the dismissal of a case on appeal without affecting the underlying judgment. Couldn't do it in 20 seconds, but yeah, there's be a lot more to come.
Okay, we'll speak to you again. Norm Pattis, lawyer who defended several rioters. Thanks very much for joining us on NewsHour. I'm Nuala McGovern in Washington, D.C. Rebecca Kesby's in London.
Thanks, Nuala. Yes, lots more coming from Washington later in the programme. We're going to be hearing from an undocumented migrant who's worried by the new Trump administration's crackdown on immigration.
as a mother of two daughters, I'm trying to make a family emergency plan. I'm putting all my documents, important documents, together in case I was deported.
Other headlines this hour. Israeli security forces have launched a wide-ranging operation in the West Bank, which Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says aims to eradicate terrorism there. We'll have more on that story in a moment. And the Turkish authorities have detained four people, including a hotel owner, after more than 60 people have been killed in a fire at a ski resort. We'll bring you the latest on that too this hour. You're with NewsHour live from the BBC. Nuala McGovern in Washington, D.C. today, and me, Rebecca Kesby, in London. Let's just take a quick look at the international reaction to some of President Trump's big announcements so far that we've been hearing from Nuala. There's a lot to choose from, so we'll just focus for the moment on his decision to withdraw the U.S. from the World Health Organization. That's a U.N. body created after World War II with the chief aim of preventing infectious disease, and also that decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement again. Earlier today, this is what the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, had to say about her approach to the new Trump administration.
A lot is at stake for both sides. So, our first priority will be to engage early, discuss common interests, and be ready to negotiate. We will be pragmatic, but we will always stand by our principles. We will protect our interests and uphold our values, because that is the European way.
Ursula von der Leyen speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos today. Well, I've been speaking to our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale, for international reaction to those two major decisions. First of all, America's withdrawal from the WHO and the decision to leave the Paris Climate Agreement.
Well, I don't think there's been any surprise. Both of these decisions were pretty well flagged. And so there was no sudden shock this was going to happen. Maybe a bit of the speed. Let's take one after the other. The World Health Organization, that's not going to happen fast. It's over a 12-month period. But as you say, this is a body that is largely funded by the United States. And I think there'll be two direct consequences. One is just straightforward health programs in developing countries around the world, especially Africa, will just stop if the Americans stop. You know, huge swathes of, you know, many countries' basic health needs are provided for by the WHO, and it will no longer be able to do it unless the Americans or our money is found from elsewhere. Secondly, the huge issue about future pandemics, because the US will now be withdrawing themselves from that process. So what does that mean for the US if there's another COVID Mark II or another pandemic in years to come? And what does it mean for the rest of the world if the US is taken out of that system of creating resilience to pandemics? As for the Paris climate change, again, expected. The Germans have said it's a fatal signal for the world. The Europeans have said it was an unfortunate development. The interesting point, though, is that a lot of people have been saying, look, this is America shooting itself in the foot economically, because if it pulls out of Paris, then potentially it's withdrawing itself from hugely lucrative future markets in renewable energy, and it's leaving the markets open for competitors such as China.
Which we heard there in the headlines, didn't we? They had an announcement to make on that today. It is the first full day of Mr. Trump's term. He has promised in the past to end the war in Ukraine on day one, so he's still got a few hours to go on that. But are we expecting any announcements? We know that the Kremlin has said it's open to dialogue, and President Zelensky's been speaking at Davos today.
Well, the president was asked about this overnight when he was signing all his executive orders in the Oval Office. And he said very explicitly, he said, I think Zelensky wants to make a deal. I don't know if Putin does. He might not. He should make a deal. I think he's destroying Russia by not making a deal. Now, that is the key question that is hanging over Donald Trump, is can he persuade Vladimir Putin to come to the table? Because a lot of people are very sceptical about that. As for President Zelensky, he's just been on his feet talking to the European leadership at the Davos World Economic Forum. And I was incredibly struck by the firmness of his tone. He was lecturing Europe, basically saying, look, if Trump demands 5% of your income spent on defence, well, so be it. He said, you know, don't play for people's emotions by talking about cuts to medicine and pensions. That's not fair. You've got to do it. And so very, very firm remarks saying, look, Europe's got to stand up on this.
And that was our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale, there. In other news today, the Palestinian health authorities say six people have been killed and around 35 injured after Israeli military forces launched a major operation in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military says it's a counter-terror offensive. Jenin, of course, has been a flashpoint in the past, but it all comes as the ceasefire in Gaza is only in its third day. The BBC's Jonah Fisher has been following events from Jerusalem.
Jenin is a particularly volatile West Bank city and always seen as something of a hotbed of Palestinian groups. And Israeli forces do go in there periodically to look for fighters from militant groups such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad who are based there now. For several weeks, the Palestinian Authority security forces have been carrying out an operation against militant groups in the refugee camp, which effectively joins onto Jenin itself. But today, the Israeli military went in, the Palestinian Authority pull out, and it was with some force from the Israeli side with helicopters involved. They're calling it Operation Iron Wall. There are reports on the ground that armoured bulldozers have been inside Jenin camp, digging up several streets. As you said, six Palestinians are reported to be killed, dozens injured. Prime Minister Netanyahu has made a statement in the last couple of hours, effectively linking what's happening in Jenin to battles and wars that Israel has been fighting across the region, linking it to Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen, as all fighters and groups that are linked to Iran in what he called the Iranian axis. So for him, this is all part of that linked up fight, which he says Israel is in the midst of.
And briefly on that, Jonah, have we heard from Hamas this morning? Have they issued a statement?
Yeah, Hamas has put out a statement calling on fighters, people, the Palestinian people, to support the mobilization in the West Bank to confront what they call the occupation's aggression on Jenin and to support the resistance fighters. As a slightly strange juxtaposition at the moment, because we, of course, have a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, which is in its third day. But at the same time, we have Hamas, which does, of course, have a presence in the West Bank, calling on people there to mobilize in support of Jenin and what's going on there.
Yeah, it's obviously a delicate situation at the moment with that ceasefire. Jonah, one other bit of news that just dropped in the past couple of hours, and that's that the head of Israel's military has resigned, and it seems to be over the security failings of October the 7th. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this isn't entirely unexpected. The chief of staff of the Israeli military, Major General Herzi Halevi, has announced that he will resign effective in March of this year. In his letter, which has been made public, as you said, in the last couple of hours, he said he was leaving due to my acknowledgement of responsibility for the failure of October the 7th. That's, of course, the Hamas attack of October the 7th, 2023, and that he was leaving at a time of significant successes for the military. Now, the relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Halevi has not always been a good one. There has been fairly constant briefing against each other throughout the course of this war. But what this resignation really does is it puts the spotlight very firmly back on the question of the failings that led to the attack and led to Israel not being able to thwart the attack of October the 7th, 2023. The army has accepted responsibility. The security forces has as well. Will there now be more pressure for an inquiry that will involve the politicians like Prime Minister Netanyahu as well as the military as well?
The BBC's Jonah Fisher there in Jerusalem. We'll be heading back to the team in Washington in just a moment. Let me draw your attention to the BBC Live page following events in Washington, D.C. too. Lots of details on there.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Welcome back to NewsHour. It's nearly 80 years since Soviet forces liberated the biggest Nazi concentration camp, Auschwitz-Birkenau. But a week before that, something happened which is less well known, and that's the death marches when SS guards forced tens of thousands of prisoners further west away from the advancing Red Army. Journalist Amy Leibowitz lost relatives in the Holocaust, and she's been visiting a Polish village which has just rediscovered its own troubling history.
In Bojkow's main square, by a large Catholic church, the local school teacher, Krzysztof Kruszynski, is pointing to the cobblestones we're standing on.
This is the silence witness of the death march.
With Soviet troops fast approaching the extermination camp, Auschwitz-Birkenau, SS guards forced tens of thousands of prisoners out of the camp onto what became known as the death marches. One of them passed through this village.
This is original stones from the street where the prisoners was going with the wooden shoes. And the people for sure from the village, not only they watched the death march, but they heard this terrible sound.
And yet for decades, the story of the death march here was unknown to the residents of this Polish village, Bojkow. One of those who revealed this history is a German woman, Cornelia Stieler.
Dass es diese Todesmärsche gegeben hat.
She says, I knew all my life that there were these death marches because my mother was 5 years old when she saw the death marches of the Auschwitz inmates and she remembers the clacking of the wooden shoes.
Cornelia was born 20 years after the war. She has spent years unearthing her own family's history during the war and what happened here.
Also wir wissen aus den Zeitzeugnissen.
What we know is that at these death marches, people that were too weak to walk, that collapsed, were directly shot. People that needed to go into the snow in order to urinate were shot. The next day, the streets were lined with corpses, and the farmers were covering these corpses with straw from the fields and then basically disposed of the corpses.
So why has it taken a German woman to tell today's Polish inhabitants of Bojkow about their history? Well, because until 1945, this village used to be in Germany and was the proud German village of Schönwald. Cornelia's family used to live in Schönwald, but days after the death march, like others, her family escaped further west, terrified of the advancing Soviet troops, and took their history with them. Now, 80 years later, thanks to the rediscovery of this history, the victims of the death march passing through the village are at last being commemorated with a new memorial inside the Catholic cemetery.
Es ist immer wichtig, darüber zu sprechen.
It's important in general to know of things that happened, of people that were killed, inhumanely treated, tortured. And if we look away, then it's like we're doing this a second time.
Amy Leibowitz there with that report.
You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Nuala McGovern in Washington, D.C. Rebecca Kesby is in London. Among the flurry of executive orders signed by President Trump on his first day in office were several measures aimed at cracking down on immigration, including declaring illegal immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border a national emergency. And in his inaugural address earlier in the day, he vowed that all illegal entry will be halted and that millions of criminal aliens would be deported. Molly Ball is the senior political reporter for the Wall Street Journal. So what impact may these measures have?
On the one hand, he has moved quite quickly to curtail illegal immigration, as you mentioned, declaring an emergency. People trying to cross the border through an app found their appointments canceled. The app is being shut down. So various avenues are already being taken to try to curtail border flows, which it should be said are already at quite low levels compared to the surges that we saw a few years ago. On the other hand, there are real questions about how far he intends to go and how much he can do, both with the authority that he has unilaterally as president and with the resources that are available to him. We broke the news last week in the Wall Street Journal that large-scale raids in Chicago were planned immediately, and then senior officials walked that back, saying they weren't ready to begin that process. And Trump's Borders Czar has said that they're going to need a lot more funding from Congress if they want to carry out a lot of these deportations, because you need things like detention centers to house migrants, the flights to send them back home, and a lot of other resources. So it remains to be seen exactly how quickly he wants to move or can move on his promises with immigration, even though he views this as the central promise of his presidential campaign.
Yes, it was definitely something that was very warmly received by the Trump supporters that I was surrounded by yesterday during his inaugural address. But with this particular plan, and we'll hear a little bit more about from a person in Chicago who is undocumented in just a moment. But won't Mr. Trump have a legal fight on his hands for any of the issues that he tries to push through when it comes to immigration?
Yes, definitely. And during his first term in office, he also saw many of his proposed moves on immigration challenged in the courts, often successfully. Immigration law is quite complex, and there is a large establishment of immigrant rights groups who are prepared to sue on a lot of these things. One that was widely noted was that yesterday he signed an executive order calling for an end to birthright citizenship, meaning if you're born on American soil, you automatically become an American citizen. Courts have repeatedly held for many decades that this is something that's guaranteed by the Constitution and therefore would require not an executive order, but a constitutional amendment to take away. So that will be immediately challenged. It's already been challenged, I believe, by the ACLU, and the courts will have to consider it. I wouldn't be surprised to see it go all the way to the Supreme Court, and legal scholars view it as very unlikely that this is something that Trump can indeed do with the stroke of a pen. So he is obviously pushing the boundaries of the law and trying to go as far as he possibly can. That doesn't mean that he'll be allowed to do so by the courts.
And just in our last 30 seconds or so, Molly, an executive order, stroke of the pen, very theatrical, dramatic yesterday with some that he did at the Capital One Arena, for example, with well-wishers. But how far can they go, or how powerful are they, in brief?
Well, it depends. It depends on the issue. And a lot of these things will be tied up in courts for quite a long time. And we will see exactly how far his authority goes. You know, his critics would say that Trump has always aspired to be a sort of strongman. He doesn't have a lot of regard for the checks and balances guaranteed by the Constitution or the countervailing powers of the legislative and judicial branches. So it's going to be quite a fight with all of the branches of government, including, I think, the executive branch, for him to try to implement all of the things he wants to do in multiple areas.
Molly Ball, senior political reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Well, I also got to speak to Erica, who is an undocumented or legal migrant in Chicago. She's been living in the States since fleeing violence in Mexico 11 years ago. And I began by asking Erica whether she watched Donald Trump's inauguration ceremony.
I didn't, because when I saw the televisions and knew about him, I don't feel really well. Yeah.
And what is that feeling that you get, Erica, if you see Mr. Trump on the television speaking?
He usually speaks very bad about immigrants. And I am an immigrant in this country. So I don't feel really well because he wants to put us out of this country.
Yeah. And it's specifically about undocumented migrants or illegal migrants. People use different language. How long, and you do not have papers in the United States, is my understanding?
Yeah, I'm an undocumented immigrant and I have been living here all the time.
Why did you leave?
Well, I left my country because there were a lot of crime at that moment. In my town, my mother-in-law was kidnapped. Several months after that, my husband was kidnapped. I had a 5 months daughter, and the only thing I thought at that moment was, I don't want this kind of life for my daughter.
Mm. What are you thinking about now for the future? That there's a couple of things. I mean, what Mr. Trump is talking about so far has been about deporting criminal aliens, is the term he used, and declaring a national emergency at the country's border with Mexico. So that would be about people hoping to come in now, for example, may find it more difficult. Does that in any way soothe your concerns? Do you feel like you will be targeted?
Well, I'm not a criminal, I can say that. But he has been saying that he is going to deport any immigrants here, any undocumented immigrants. So I think he is not going to focus only on criminals. He wants to put out everybody that has not a work permit, the Social Security or an immigration benefit.
And yeah. So you're in Chicago, that's called a sanctuary city, meaning that the local officials won't turn over in immigration status to federal officials, for example. So there is kind of a refuge for people. Does that make you feel like you may not be targeted?
President Trump has been saying that he's going to focus in Chicago City since mm-hmm. yesterday. And we can stay at home all the time. We need to go to work. We need to go to the school. We need to go to the grocery shopping. I think they have been saying ICE is going to be around the city. So we don't know what is going to really happen.
Is this something that you're thinking about every day? Or is it more a fear that kind of comes into your mind every now and again?
Yeah, you know what? I try to not to think much about this thing. I don't think there is much we can do. But of course, I, as a mother of two daughters, I'm trying to make a family emergency plan. I'm putting all my documents, important documents, together. And now I'm trying to fill out a document in case I was deported, anybody else can take care of my two daughters. Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Yeah. What else can we do at this point?
If you had to be deported, for example, would you not take your daughter or daughters with you? Do you still think they'd have a better life in the United States than Mexico?
Yes, of course. I'm really sure about that.
That they would have a better life in the U.S.?
Yes, they are American citizens. They have the right to live here. I don't really understand the hate to immigrants like me and many other immigrants that live in the United States, that we don't have criminal records. We pay taxes every year. And the only thing we want is an opportunity to get a job, to save the money and to put our kids at the college. I don't see what's the damage to this country if we live here.
And that was Erica. She's a migrant, undocumented or illegal in Chicago. But how much of a priority will people like Erica be for the new Trump program? I got to speak to Laura Reese. She's director of the Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative think tank based here in Washington, D.C.
Not a priority. The Trump officials, appointees, have said that they are going to start with national security threats, serious criminals, murders, rapists, smugglers, traffickers, etc., as well as the over 1 million aliens who went through due process before an immigration judge, but the judge ordered their removal, and those aliens absconded and are still here with a final order of removal. Those will be where the Trump administration starts.
How difficult would it be, though, to track down, particularly that last group you just mentioned that absconded?
There is going to be some info in ICE and other DHS databases, perhaps using Social Security information, other commercial information as well. But the Trump administration has its work cut out for it due to the last 4 years and the millions who the Biden administration led into the country unlawfully.
It's interesting because even Erica, my last guest, I know she doesn't have a Social Security card, for example, or that sort of tracking. Just to mention, ICE is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, DHS, Department of Homeland Security for those that are not American. I'm also interested in Mr. Trump's plan to end birthright citizenship, citizenship at birth. It's considered enshrined in the Constitution. I imagine there would be challenges to that. He would like, if Erica's kids, for example, were born in the States, that she could still be deported, for example, that they wouldn't automatically become American citizens if she were undocumented or any other parent. Do you think that'll actually go through?
I'm sure that it will be challenged in court, but I do think it will be successful. The Constitution says that a person who has citizenship born here is subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. It was passed right after the Civil War. It was not passed to deal with illegal immigration. And what this executive order says is if you are born here and your parent is not a lawful permanent resident or a U.S. citizen, you will not receive documents such as a passport that shows that you are a U.S. citizen. That is quite common among other nations across the globe. And so I do anticipate that when challenged in court, that this finding will be successful.
Interesting. Laura, I've just got about 20 seconds. I'm just curious. Do you think Elon Musk, for example, looking for an expansion of H-1B visas for skilled workers, is that something you would also support in our last 20 seconds?
Well, that program has been heavily defrauded, so it needs a lot of reforms. I don't anticipate the ceiling being raised, at least initially, unless and until there are protections put in and enforced to make sure it's not being defrauded.
Laura Reese, this is NewsHour.
Now let's look at another big story today. South Korea's suspended president Yoon Suk-yeol has appeared at a constitutional court hearing for the first time this morning. He's been impeached following his declaration of martial law in December. He now faces criminal charges as well as the possibility that this constitutional court may ban him from politics forever. So it's been another dramatic day in the South Korean capital, Seoul, where our correspondent Jeans McKenzie was outside the court today.
Security has been incredibly tight here in Seoul today, as you might imagine, because the president had to be transported from the detention center where he's currently being held to the courtroom. And so the police had cordoned off all the roads leading to the court. So only the police and us journalists were allowed to be there. That was because they wanted to get Mr. Yoon's supporters right back away from the court. Hundreds of them had gathered today nearby, as they have been day after day. But because of this security, they just couldn't have them anywhere near. But there was quite a big showing, I'd say a good few hundred people out on the streets protesting this this hearing today and supporting President Yoon. So it was all very dramatic.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And we have actually heard from Mr. Yoon himself today because he was speaking in court. What did he say?
Yeah, and this in itself was quite a moment. Not only is it his first appearance at his impeachment trial, but it's really the first time that we've seen him in public since he declared martial law. And it's also the first time that a president has even turned up at their own impeachment trial to try and defend themselves, which I think shows you how strongly he is choosing to fight this. So he came today really to make his case. He argued that he hadn't breached the constitution by declaring martial law, because that is what these constitutional judges are here to decide. Did he break the constitution or not? So in his words, no, he didn't. He was within his right to declare martial law. And he and his lawyers claimed that that night he hadn't intended to fully shut down the parliament, and that he'd brought in the troops not to arrest the lawmakers and stop them from voting this down, but to protect the public. But the prosecutors, well, they didn't buy this. They responded today. They were saying that his comments were unclear, they were irrational, and they even accused Mr. Yoon of evading responsibility.
So this is just the beginning, isn't it, of the impeachment process. What happens next? And also, of course, Mr. Yoon is facing separate criminal investigations too.
So with the impeachment trial, yeah, that we're about a week into that. That's going to continue. We know for another few weeks. We have the court listings. We don't know how long. The judges have 6 months to decide that, but we think it's going to happen a lot sooner. On the criminal side of things, that is why Mr. Yoon has been arrested. It's why he's now currently in detention. He's yet to be charged. So the investigators and the prosecutors, they still have a number of days to question him and decide whether or not they have enough evidence to bring those charges. But at the moment, Mr. Yoon is not cooperating with that side of the process at all. He's refusing to answer questions. So for the past few days, he's refused to even leave his prison cell and come into the investigators' offices for questioning. They even went yesterday to try and forcibly remove him and bring him in themselves. And I think it's interesting to look at how he is choosing to relate to both these processes. With the impeachment process, he is coming out strong. He wants to fight it. He wants to fight it publicly. But the criminal proceedings, he will not engage with, because he is trying to claim that they are invalid, that there are no grounds to prosecute him.
The BBC's Jean McKenzie in Seoul. In Turkey, a huge fire at a popular ski resort in the northwestern district of Bolu has killed at least 66 people, but the interior minister said he feared the number could rise even further. The fire broke out at the Grand Kartal Hotel in the early hours of this morning, and one report suggests it could have started in the restaurant area. Emily Wither is a freelance journalist based in Istanbul, and a short time ago she gave us the latest.
Well, we're still learning the details. It's an incredibly shocking incident, because this is a very popular hotel. I have Turkish colleagues that have stayed there, many friends. I've looked at staying at this hotel myself. It's a bit of an institution. It's very popular with people looking to get away for the weekend from Istanbul. It's about 4 hours from where I am now, and from the capital, Ankara. And it's the school holidays here in Turkey, so there would have been many families there. The hotel was almost fully booked with over 230 guests. As you said there, it's believed that the restaurant was the cause of the fire, that a fire started down there on the lower ground, but then it spread rapidly. Partly, it's believed because the front of the hotel is a wooden structure, and so the fire was able to spread quite rapidly. But there's a lot of anger now as to how this could have happened. For example, it took fire crews 45 minutes to arrive on the site. Mm. And the scenes that we can see are just shocking. Shattered windows, white sheets tied together, dangling out of the window because people had to try and escape from their windows. Other guests have spoken about placing hotel pillows on the ground so people could jump out of windows.
Yeah, I mean, you say there's been some terrible stories that have come out, as you say, lots of people jumping from the windows, which would be causing injury as well. And I think there are still people that they're trying to find, aren't they? Tell us a bit more, though, on this sort of criticism that there's been already. There seems to be fury over the safety regulations. Apparently, there are no smoke detectors. Do we know that for sure?
Well, that's certainly what hotel guests are saying. One hotel guest was talking to local television, and they were saying this hotel guest was in tears, and he was saying there were no safety measures, no fire escape, no smoke detectors, no fire extinguishers. And that's been repeated by other guests that have survived this fire. The local mayor said that he didn't know if there was a fire escape or not because he didn't have any information, because they didn't issue the license. The local municipality didn't issue a license. It was licensed by the Ministry of Tourism in 1977, as it sits within a national park. And there's so much angry reaction online now from Turks who are talking generally about how unsafe buildings are in Turkey. Turkey has now imposed a broadcast ban inside the country on reporting this. They say it's because the evidence is still being gathered and they don't want disinformation to spread. But I think they're also concerned about the rising public anger now about how this could have happened and how this very upmarket, well-known hotel didn't have the right regulations. The Justice Minister has said that they've arrested four people already, and they've now thrown a huge team on this. They've announced there'll be six public prosecutors assigned, and in addition, a five-person expert committee has been formed to carry out an investigation. So I think we'll learn a bit more about what regulations were in place in the coming days.
Emily Weather in Istanbul there. Just before we go, news in that Marco Rubio has been sworn in as US Secretary of State. Vice President J.D. Vance heard his oath. That's it for this hour from Nuala McGovern and the team in Washington, D.C. and me, Rebecca Kesby, and everyone here in London. Thanks for joining us wherever you are in the world.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.